So I'd like to begin discussing the Arba Banim, the four sons that we discuss in the Haggadah. We have Chacham, the smart, wise, knowledgeable guy, the Rasha, the, so to speak, the evil son, and the Tam, the guy who's, you know, kind of like tame, regular, laid-back guy, and She'enei De'alishal, the one who's very not with it, he doesn't even know what to ask, doesn't even know how to ask. So the Haggadah deals with each and every one of those in a very different way. First of all, let's try to understand, why do you need four sons? What's the whole idea of having four sons, like four different personalities at the Seder? Well, what's that all about? Let's try to understand the approach to each and every one. The Rasha, the Chacham, let's focus first on the Rasha. The Rasha says, "Ma avayda zeislachem." What is this work for you, right? So what do we answer? Lachem v'lo ilo. Meaning he's referring it as like, this is your work. It's not me. I'm not part of this. Lachem v'lo ilo. It's for you and not for him. Ilu hoyasham lo yinigol. If he was there in Mitzrayim, in Egypt, he would not have merited to join the Exodus and come out of Egypt. Because we'll understand a little as we go along what that means. And then it's very interesting. We don't answer him. Right? All the other sons, it says Valmartala, you tell him. By the Rosh, it says Valmartim, you just say. Why? Because if someone's coming to, so to speak, to question you and say, oh, what are you guys doing? What's that all about? Then you don't have to answer him. You don't answer him on the defensive. You're not going to get him. What are you coming to do? You're coming to answer yourself, to strengthen yourself, to help yourself understand what you're doing, what you're talking about. Where do we answer the Rasha? We kind of, on a side note, we answer the Rasha when we deal with the last son, She'enu De'alishal, the one who doesn't know how to ask. He's totally clueless. He doesn't know what's going on. Over there, we silently answer him, and the She'enu De'alishal, we tell him, that the Rasha would not be part of the Exodus, he wouldn't be part of the Gula. Now, why are we, of all the sons, why are we using the last one, the guy who has no clue what's going on, why are we using him to explain that we're supposed to be part of the Exodus, we're supposed to be here to tell over the story, and the Rasha is not part of that? If anyone, we should use maybe the Chacham to answer the Rasha, the smart one to answer the evil one, or maybe the Tam, the guy who's, you know, relaxed and tame. Why are we using the guy who's totally clueless to answer the evil son? Why are we using him of all the sons? It doesn't really make much sense. So let's try to understand a little bit more what Pesach night is all about. When we compare Judaism to other religions, the Khazri talks about it, and he analyzes the basics of every single religion. Let's start with Christianity. Christianity believes that Jesus, Yahshua, was the Son of God. He had to suffer in this world to atone for our sins, and he ended up dying on the cross, and later on there was the resurrection where he came back to life. Now, did anyone see Jesus being the Son of God? Did anyone see God sign the birth certificate? Did anyone see God give out cigars when he was born? No. It's basically his word against everybody else's. We don't know. Could be he happened, could be he didn't. I don't know. Could we believe the man? Maybe yes, maybe no. Now, the resurrection. Over there, there were witnesses who witnessed the resurrection. It was a small group of his closest Talmidim, his closest students, and another group of fuming women. Women who were basically fainting. They were going in and out of consciousness. Now, his students knew that if he did not come back to life, they were basically out of a job. So they were pretty biased. And the women, now nothing against the credibility of women, but swooning women, women who were fainting, how much credibility does that have? You basically have a group of people who are either not really conscious, or people who are biased. Not exactly such a credible basis to start a religion on. Who would believe them? How about Islam? That's even worse. Islam basically believes that Muhammad was sleeping in the cave one night, and the Malach, the angel Gavriel, came down to him, revealed the Quran to him, and told him to spread it around the world. Now, maybe it happened, maybe it didn't. Maybe he had a dream, maybe he had a stomachache, I don't know. Who said it happened? Now, he actually was able to convince, Islam were able to convince many, many people in many, many countries to convert to Islam. He had a very, very convincing argument. The argument went basically something like this. Either you accept my religion, or I cut your head off. So many people found that to be extremely convincing. And therefore, they ended up joining Islam. The Rambam and both the Ramban, Maimonides and Achmanides, both talk about it, why Islam and Christianity were the ones to be spread around the world. They say it was better than what came before, paganism, and it paves the way for Mashiach to come. Rambam talks about it in the end of Hilchos Malachim. We can talk about that maybe a different time. But in any case, those are the two main religions that are accepted in the world nowadays. Again, both of them do not have such a strong basis. Let's look at Judaism for a minute. Judaism is based on, well, we know we have 600,000 men between the ages of 20 and 60 who ended up leaving Egypt during the Exodus. So if you double that by the women, you had 600,000 women, let's say, between the ages of 20 and 60. Then you've got all the kids, boys and girls, under the ages of 20. You've got the men and women over the ages of 60. So you've got roughly between 2 and 2.5 million Jews who witnessed not only the 10 plagues in Egypt, they witnessed the splitting of the sea, and they were there on Mount Sinai when God spoke directly to them. Now let's try to see if that's credible or not. Option number one is it actually happened, just the way it says in the Torah. Option number two, never happened. However, Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, was very charismatic, extremely convincing, and he managed to convince 2.5 million people that of something that never happened. Could that be? Maybe. It could be. It's a possibility. Not probable, but it's a possibility. Emunah is belief is something that we have to choose. There always has to be another option. Otherwise, we wouldn't have free will. You know, we're supposed to have free will either to choose to believe, or there could be another possibility. Maybe it might be unlikely, but it's there. That's why we have a mitzvah. We have a special commandment of Emunah to go ahead and actively believe, because it's not 100% obvious. There's always that slight chance that maybe it didn't happen. So let's try to analyze that option for a minute. That Moses made the whole thing up, and he managed to convince 2.5 million Jews in something that never happened. So imagine for a minute, I came in the room, I'm white as a ghost, and I tell you guys, listen, you have to hear what happened to me. On the way here, I was driving, there were no other cars around, and all of a sudden, a saucer lands on top of my car. 10 green aliens get out of the saucer, dance around my car, get back into the saucer, and fly away. I know you're not going to believe me, but I'm telling you what happened. I've got to get it off my chest. Would you believe me? Yes or no?
Sure.
Yeah? You would believe me.
I'm a shaker, go guns.
Yeah, man, you know, listen. If I was, you know, really shaken up, and I really felt like I had this experience, you know, you probably wouldn't believe me, but maybe, there's a slight chance, maybe I was drunk, maybe I was hallucinating, you never know. There's a slight chance it did happen. Right? Could be, let's say. But what if I tell you, you guys remember last week, Tuesday night, we were all sitting here, I was giving the shiur, and in the middle of my shiur last week, a saucer came in through that door, landed on the table right here, 10 green men got out, danced all around us, and then got back into the saucer and flew away. Right? You remember that happened, right? You remember, last week. Exactly last week, Tuesday night, that happened right here. Oh, you all witnessed it.
You paid us off to give you the answer.
Right? Would you believe that? Yeah?
No, obviously
you would never believe that. Why? Because I'm telling you something that you experienced that you never did.
No.
So to say that Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, managed to convince 2.5 million Jews of something they never experienced, it's kind of far-fetched. Not such a strong possibility. The commentators explain, you know, it's hard enough to convince Jews that they saw what they didn't see, let alone what they didn't see. Right? The Reb Shamshon of Fel Hirsch explains that one of the biggest proofs that the Torah is true is that we accepted it. Now, Jews are obviously very, very hard to convince. And if we accepted it as true, it must be that it actually happened. Okay, so that possibility is not so likely. What's another possibility? Another possibility is that it never happened. Never happened. However, the Jews were oppressed in Egypt. And they managed to leave Egypt, and to start their own nation. But they said, you know, what kind of history is that? We came from slavery and we were oppressed. Let's make up this whole glorious story. These amazing miracles happened. 10 plagues. And splitting of the sea, it sounds so much more dramatic. Yeah, that's how the Jewish people begun, right? They made it up. So we'll have a very, very majestic, beautiful history. Right? That could be. If that's what happened, then why is it that everyone not only accepted that, they accepted the Torah that was tagged onto it? Not only was there the splitting of the sea, but there were also 613 mitzvahs attached to it. Right? That's a pretty big package to accept. Who would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and put on black boxes on their head if they didn't actually believe that it has to do with their eternal welfare? Now, even if it was true, and parents, you know, maybe they were abusive to their kids, they wanted to tell them, you know, about these 613 mitzvahs, make them believe it, even though it never happened. Many people become extremely honest on their deathbed. So on their deathbed, the parents call over their kids and tell them, listen, the black boxes at 5 o'clock in the morning, forget about it. We made it up. It doesn't really exist. It never happened. The whole splitting of the sea never happened. If it was really true that we made it up, it would not go on for all these generations passed on by father to son, with such strong authenticity. All the sons knowing for sure that it actually happened. If it didn't really happen, we just made it up, it would not remain for all those generations. We're talking about thousands and thousands of years. So that possibility is not probable either. Let's talk about another possibility. It never happened. However, Ezra, he was the prophet after the destroying of the first temple. When the Jewish people came back to Israel 70 years later, Ezra was the one who led them back to Israel. And he woke up one morning, it was a rainy day, he had nothing better to do, and he decided to make up the whole story. 10 plagues, splitting of the sea, the Torah. And he told the Jews, you know where you guys came from? You were in Egypt, you were slaves, and God took you out with 10 plagues, and it was amazing. Why didn't anyone raise their hand and say, by the way, Ezra, if this is true, why didn't any one of us hear about this? We never heard about this for 1,000 years. This has been a secret, no one knew about it, only you. Right? Nobody raised their hand, and everyone just accepted it blindly. Not only that, but they had to accept the Torah, which meant that they had to divorce many of their wives. They were married to non-Jews, and the Torah tells them they're not allowed to marry non-Jews. And they just accepted it, yeah, for sure, 100%. Yeah, the Torah that you just made up, no one ever heard of. Because of that, we're going to divorce our wife. Is that possible? I don't think so. What's the last possibility? That, you know what, it did happen, something happened. They were slaves, there's some kind of oppression, and they had a few strikes. They left Egypt, and they walked through some kind of puddle, and then they got the Torah, whatever it was. And over the generations, it got exaggerated, it got blown out of proportion. The puddle turned into a river, the river turned into a pond, and then they went scuba diving. The next generation said, we built a bridge over. And then they said, oh, no, that doesn't sound good. Let's say that the sea split, right? And then finally we got to this version that we have today, that the sea split. Over all the generations, it got exaggerated, and this is the final story that we have today. Now, let's analyze that for a minute. You guys all know the game Broken Telephone, right? Broken Telephone, in England they call it Chinese Whispers, for some weird reason. In any case, if you would take a group of 10 people, and you would line them up, you would give a message to everyone at the beginning of the group, and you would have all 10 groups give over the message, and then you would go to the last person in each group and ask him what he heard. What are the odds that every single guy at the end will end up getting the same message? Not pretty high. Right? For some reason, if it was really, in fact, exaggerated over the generations, how did every single family, every single community all over the world, every Jewish community, ended up with exactly the same version? 10 plagues, the splitting of the sea, everyone ended up with the same thing. If it was really exaggerated over the generations, we should have had hundreds, if not thousands, of different versions. Every community has a different, you know, imagination. Yeah, this happened, that happened. Every community should have their own version. Every family would have their own version of what happened. But that didn't happen. Everyone has exactly the same version of what happened. Furthermore, imagine for a minute you had 10 people walking through the Amazon. Each one of them is within earshot of the other. Meaning, guy number 3 can communicate with guy number 2 and guy number 4. They're all walking like that, single file, through the Amazon. All of a sudden, they sink in the sand, and they're unable to move. Now, guy number 1 and 2 are walking together, and guy number 1 starts having a seizure. His face turns blue, his tongue is sticking out, he's choking, and guy number 2 wants to help him, but he doesn't know what to do. Now, guy number 10 is a doctor. So he sends a message to guy number 3, describing the symptoms that guy number 1 is exhibiting. And it's going to go all the way back to the doctor. And the doctor will tell him what to do, send it all the way back to guy number 2. Over there, not only will it not be broken because they know the importance of this message. The life of guy number 1 depends on the accuracy of the message that's being passed on. So too, we know that our eternal warfare is dependent on the authenticity and accuracy of what happened in Egypt, of the Torah, all the rules, and all the mitzvahs. Everything we have is dependent on that. Therefore, it's not a broken telephone. You know, a broken telephone, it's fun where it gets broken up. You want to see, you know, who messed up. And you want to see what kind of message you end up with. It's very different over here. We know that it's extremely important. We do everything we can to make sure that it's being passed on exactly the way it's supposed to be. And that's exactly what we're doing at the Seder. At the Seder, we're building the next generation, the next link in this long, long, long chain, all the way back to the people, the Jews who left Egypt. And we're trying to build the next link in a strong way to make sure that it's being given over in an accurate, precise way. Because we know how important it is. The Torah tells us, "L'man tesaper be'ozni bincha u'ben bincha." You should give over the story to the ears of your son and your grandson. Two questions. Why does it say you have to give it over to the ears of your son and grandson? They didn't have ears. What did I give it over to? His big toe? Obviously, I'm going to tell it to his ears. Who else am I going to tell it to? And why does it say the son and the grandson? If I'm going to give it over to the son, my son will give it over to his son, to my grandson. Why do I need to give it over to my grandson? So the period, one of the commentators explains that every son, every person, every child has his own way, his own personality, his own way of receiving things. You have to customize the story of Exodus in a way that your son or daughter will accept it and understand it. You can't just give her over a generic story. Yeah, this is what happened, and 10 plagues, 1, 2, 3, 4, okay, done. You have to give it over into a way that will be interesting, intriguing, get him involved, get him interested. That's what it's all about. And why do you have to tell your grandson? Because every single link is going all the way back to the Jews that left Egypt. Now, the grandfather is one generation closer to that experience. Therefore, it's very nice to hear from your father, but if you hear from your grandfather, you're hearing it from one step closer to that time. Therefore, it's much more real, much more authentic. That's what we're doing on Pesach night. That's why it's so important to give it over in such a way. We have to relive the experience. The Agada tells us, Chayav Adam Liris HaSatma Kilu Hu Yotzam Mitzrayim. Every person has to look at himself. He has to really experience the Exodus and the fact that we lived through the 10 plagues and left Mitzrayim. So let me ask you a question. If we really have to experience this, why is it that we do something very interesting on the Seder night? Torah says that every geula has a double letter. The first geula was Lech Lecha. Lech Lecha, the end of Lech Lecha is Chaf. Chaf is that letter that has it's in the alphabet. Right, every the beginning of it and the end of it is equal. And then you have Pakoit Pakadati, that's in the Exodus. Pei is that same letter where it's doubled. And the Torah tells us that in Pei, there's a Pe Pasuach and Pe Sasum. There's an open Pei and a closed Pei. Pei is referring to the mouth. Pesach is about the mouth talking. In Hebrew, Pesach literally means a mouth talking. And the closed mouth is referring to eating. When you eat, you close your mouth. The whole thing we do on Pesach is we talk and we eat. That's all we do. We talk about what happened in Egypt, and we eat the matzah, we eat the marar. That's all we're doing. So let me ask you a question. If we really wanted to experience what it meant to be a slave in Egypt, to suffer, and then to finally leave the enslavement, why don't we do something completely different? If you guys come over to my Seder next week, this is what we're going to do. I'm going to split you guys up to two groups, Group A and Group B. I'm going to give Group A a bunch of whips and clubs, and I'm going to give Group B cement, building materials, and bricks. Now, I'm going to tell Group A, you guys have to beat up Group B as they build pyramids for a quarter of the night. After a quarter of the night, I blow my whistle, I say, okay guys, switch. Now Group A is going to beat up Group B while they build pyramids. And at midnight, I'm going to blow my whistle and say, okay guys, that's it, it's over, you guys are free to go. You're free, you can do whatever you want, you can enjoy Pesach. That night, you guys would really feel what it means to be a slave and go out of slavery. Now you might not come to my Seder next year, but you're definitely going to know what it feels like to be a slave. Instead, what do? We eat lettuce. Well, all that accomplishes is making me feel like a rabbit. How do I experience being a slave in Egypt? What good does that do? Another idea is, maybe we should put up a play, right? Every family should have their play. One guy will be Pharaoh, another guy will be Moses. You're going to have the Jews that are being enslaved. And everyone will have a play, be part of the experience. It'll be a family and friends experience, put up a play to make it real. Why don't we do that? That'll be a real experience. Instead of what we do is eat matzah, we eat marah. What's that all about? What are we trying to achieve with that. Doesn't seem like it's very effective at first glance. So, it's brought down by the Michtav Melio the following idea. It used to be, back in the days in America, I don't know if you guys remember this, but there were drive-in movies, there would be a big parking lot, a big screen, you would drive in with your car, and they would show the movie, you know, at the end of the movie or in the middle of the movie, they would sell Coke, popcorn, and that's where they made their money. They wouldn't make their money on the money you would come to pay in, but you would make the money on the popcorn and the Coke that they sold. Now, in the beginning, they tried to advertise at the end of the movie how cold the Coke is, the popcorn is so crunchy and salty, amazing. They found it's not that effective. What's much more effective is what's called subliminal advertising. In the middle of the movie, they would have either these tiny flashes of Coca-Cola on the screen, they would show a bottle of Coke on the table, and you would have this urge, I've got to drink a bottle of Coke. In the middle of the movie, in the break, they would come over with a bottle of Coke, and people would just buy a ton of it. They found that was much more effective. So now, when I try to go ahead and experience what it means to be in Egypt, to be a slave, and to finally leave Egypt, what we're trying to do here is the same kind of thing. Subliminal advertising. Now, just an analogy. If I wanted to move some data from my laptop on to my smartphone, what am I going to do? I'm going to go to Home Depot. I'm going to buy their strongest rope, tie my smartphone to my laptop, but tie it as strong as I can, make the really, really strong knot, and try to squish them together, and that's how the data is going to go from my laptop to my iPhone. Right?
Of course.
Wrong. Why wrong? I need a USB cord. I need to put it into the USB port in my phone, then connect it to the USB port in the laptop, and the data goes through this cord into my smartphone. Now, it doesn't seem very effective, right? You know, this cord, the data is going to go through the cord into my phone. Now, it's got to be the right cord, right? It's got to be the right USB port. It's got to be the right entrance. You can't just use any cord. Everything has to be very, very customized and very, very accurate. When we try to go ahead and reconnect the events that happened in Egypt all these years ago, that's exactly what we're doing. We're connecting a USB cord from our neshama to those events. Now, how does that happen? So, the timeline is very interesting. It's not exactly a straight line. It's more like a circle. Let's say we take the beginning of the year, Rosh Hashanah, or the 1st of November, of January, sorry. And on the first year, yeah? And we go around the year. Then at the end of December, let's say, it's kind of like an elevator shaft. The elevator goes up one floor, and it begins a new cycle, a new year, right? It goes all around, again, until the end of December, goes up another floor number two, and it goes around again. So basically, all these events that happened, let's say, thousands of years ago, are in that elevator shaft, all the way down, thousands and thousands of floors down. It's all the way there. It's there on the bottom, but it's in that same elevator shaft. So every time a year, every time it comes around again, that time of year has that power, the power of those events, the spirituality of those events in there. We have to connect those thousands of years all the way down to the bottom of that elevator shaft, so to speak. And what we're doing is we're connecting USB cord from our neshama into those events. Now, there's a very customized, special way of doing that. You have to eat lettuce, you have to eat a kazayas of matzah. That's the spiritual, deeper way. That's the way Hashem set up our neshama to receive and to connect to those events, to the spirituality, to the nisim that happened in those days. That's exactly what we're doing. And that's why it's so important that we do exactly that. that we eat the matzah, exactly this much of matzah, exactly this much of lettuce, of maror. And we talk about these experiences, the 10 plagues, we talk about this, we talk about that. Everything is customized, just like the USB cord is exactly customized to my smartphone and to the laptop that I have. If I use the wrong USB cord, it's not going to work. It's just not going to connect. I won't be able to put it into my smartphone. I won't be able to connect it to the laptop. If we don't have the right program, the USB port is not going to recognize my smartphone. Everything has to be exactly customized, hand-custom, and personally designed to spiritually connect to the energy of the Nisim and the events that happened thousands of years ago. And that's why it's so important to go through the Seder, to live the experiences that happened all those thousands of years ago, and if we do exactly the way it's supposed to be, the way it's brought down in the Agada, then our neshamas will awaken, and we'll be able to create another generation, another link in that long chain of generations who will again relive that experience, and they will come together finally to bring Mashiach. That's what it's all about. That's why it's so important that the Seder is done exactly in that way. Be'ezer Hashem, we should all be zeicha to experience the Seder, to connect to these events, and to understand what everything is all about. Shkoyach. Right, we didn't yet answer what it means, these four sons. So we've got the evil son over here. What does it mean to be the Rasha, the evil son? Does that mean he's actually such an evil person? It's brought down in Halacha, it's brought down that someone who cuts his nails, and there are three options. Either you bury them, or you throw them out. Now, the person who throws them out on the street is called a Rasha. What does that mean, that he's a Rasha? You want to tell me that if the person davens three times a day, he learns Torah, he does all the mitzvahs, but he throws his nails on the street, he's called a Rasha, and Rosh Hashanah, he's going to be signed in that book of Rishayim, of evil men, just because he threw his nails on the street? Doesn't make much sense. What does it mean? It means that in every single area, there are two ways of doing it. There's the right way of doing it, and there's the Rasha way of going about it. The Rasha way of nails is throwing them in the street. Doesn't mean you are a Rasha, that's who, the title of the person who you are. It means that in that area, there's the Rasha, you're going about the Rasha way of doing things. Now, a Rasha and the Seder is someone who's willing to come, he's going to join, he's going to drink 3-4 cups of wine, he's going to eat the matzah, he'll even eat the lettuce, but he doesn't want to give it over to the next generation. He doesn't want to experience what it means to live in Tzrayim. He doesn't want to connect that USB cord into his neshama and connect it to those events, to the energy, to the spirituality of what happened all those thousands of years ago. Now, Asheinu Yodei Lishaal is someone who doesn't know what to ask. He's clueless. He doesn't know what's going on. Now, we have to differentiate between someone who's Asheinu Yodei Lishaal, someone who doesn't know, and someone who doesn't want to be a part of it. He doesn't want to know, right? Yeah, whatever. Don't tell me. I don't want to know. I have no interest. What is he? He's a silent Rasha. He's the one who doesn't necessarily want to be a part of this. He doesn't want to give it over to the next generation. He doesn't want to find out what this is all about. He's a silent Rasha. That's why the She'enu Yodei Lishaal, the guy who doesn't know what's going on, has to be very careful. Because you have to make sure that you're not that silent Rasha and the guy who doesn't want to know. If you don't know, that's one thing. But if you don't want to know, that's very dangerous. You're that Rasha. You're that person who doesn't want to to live up to the main purpose and goal of this night. To relive the experience and give it over to the next generation. To build the next link. If you don't want to be a part of that, then you are a Rasha. You might be a silent Rasha, but you're a Rasha. That's why we're using the She'enu Yodei Lishaal to answer the Rasha. Because we're telling him, I want you to be careful and make sure that you are not that silent Rasha and you really want to be a part of things, you just don't know. Because that's what it's all about. And Beis Hashem, we should be zeichet to really connect, to want to know, to relive that experience, and give it over to the next generation.
Amen. Okay.